agree on that. It's not surprising that the people took him immediately and so powerfully. That started at the very first press conference. That is among the least surprising things that have happened so far. Gordon predicted to the AFC press department that they would be getting a Ferrari in the new manager. Kenny Dalglish, too, anticipated a white-knuckle ride. I just heard Klopp's press conference and he sounds very, very impressive, the former coach said. I think the supporters will need to fasten their seatbelts. I'm sure they will really enjoy him. Acquaintances from Germany who visited Klopp in Liverpool during his first season in England noted that everybody at Anfield and Melwood happily opened doors for them as soon as they announced that they were there to see the manager. TV reporter Martin Kvast sat in Klopp's office one day, waiting to shoot an interview, and could already hear his friends' laughter echoing through the corridors. I took a peek outside and saw Liverpool employees running about, all with huge smiles on their faces. And of course, Kloppo's there among them, making jokes and making them feel good. That's his style, that kind of openness. I remember in his place in Mainz, all the doors to the various apartments were always open, and the guy who rented the flat above him would just pop in for breakfast in the morning. He just loves having people around him. Klopp's so approachable that he's unofficially been serving as Melwood's resident agony aunt. At least one LFC employee with relationship troubles has turned to him for advice. Before the Swabians' arrival, goalkeeper Simon Mignolet had taken it upon himself to organise get-togethers and team events. Klopp sought him out and told him that there would be much more of that in the coming months. "We are one team and one family," the manager announced. That ethos expressly stretched to non-playing staff, Klopp made clear. He learned the names of all 80 employees at Melwood, lined them up in the dining hall and introduced them to the players, explaining that the squad and the staff had a responsibility to help each other achieve their best. In Klopp's mind, the match-going public too had an important role to play, even though he was reluctant to make any overt demands. At Mainz and Dortmund, he had seen players regularly tap into the stadium's energy. But Anfield, the crucible of football, didn't quite live up to its billing as a cauldron. Supporters left in droves 8 minutes before the end of the 2-1 loss against Crystal Palace in November 2015, Klopp's first defeat as a Liverpool coach. "I felt pretty alone at that moment," he said afterwards, visibly disappointed with the crowd's premature capitulation. But as a new immigrant member of the LFC community, he had to be careful not to blame the audience for the paucity of the show. The supporters' reaction was understandable and amounted to a silent but powerful commandment. He and the team had a duty to produce football that would thrill and hold the prospect of success until the very last second, he conceded. "We should be responsible that nobody can leave the stadium a minute before the end because everything can happen," Klopp said. "We have to show that, and we didn't." The Etihad proved a much more hospitable environment in the next league game. Klopp's Reds tore through the shaky Manchester City defence to win 4-1 and offer more evidence of an upturn in fortune. A year and a half later, Lallana believes that trip along the M62 marked the best game of the Klopp era so far. "I really enjoyed it. It was a real team performance," he says. A subsequent meeting with the same opponents in the final of the League Cup was altogether less pleasant for Lallana and the rest of the squad. Liverpool did well to come back for a 1-1 draw at Wembley against a City team boasting more individual quality, but lost the penalty shootout after extra time had come and gone without further goals. "We feel down now, but we have to stand up. Only silly idiots stay on the floor and wait for the next defeat," Klopp said. His frustration about losing out on his first piece of English silverware was tempered by the knowledge that Liverpool had fought valiantly, with little left in the tank. The league campaign failed to take off, however. Big wins were followed by draws and defeats against the lesser lights, in an unnerving pattern that would become familiar. 6 months after he'd started managing on Merseyside, the team was still treading water in the table outside the European places. "Jürgen has done a lot of things right," Steve McManaman told Süddeutsche Zeitung in April 2016. "He's very popular. Even fans of other clubs like him. Over the last few months, I have had plenty of Manchester United, Arsenal or Chelsea supporters coming up to me and say, 'I'd love him to be our manager.' He's very charismatic. He says the right things. People love his passion on the touchline. Jürgen's won over the fans. They believe in him. But there's an obvious lack of consistency as far as the results are concerned. Jürgen's squad doesn't have enough depth and quality to deliver 5-6 really good matches in a row." Progress didn't so much register in points as in decibels. The Kop was beginning to suspend its doubts, amassed over a near decade without a significant trophy, and find its voice again. In mid-December, Belgian striker Divock Origi scored a dramatic, very late equaliser to rescue a point for Liverpool at home to West Brom, 2-2. Klopp took the players in front of the Kop after the final whistle to show his and the team's appreciation for the unwavering support to the very end. "It was the best atmosphere since I came here," he said. "Of course people are disappointed, but they didn't let us feel that. They saw that the lads tried everything and played football." The gesture was, predictably, belittled in some quarters as an overblown celebration of a mediocre result against mediocre opposition. But Klopp didn't care about the view from the outside. The players' tribute was a piece of clever crowd management, meant to remind Anfield of its extraordinary power to influence a result. You sow the wind to reap the storm, and harvest time came quickly. The last 16 draw in the Europa League pitted Liverpool against their hated rivals, Manchester United. Europe's second competition, previously an unloved consolation prize for teams who had failed to break into the top four, offered a backdoor entrance into the Champions League for the winner and, almost as importantly, a chance to ruin United's season. Anfield, crackling with the excitement befitting a big European tie, played its assigned role in pushing the home side to a devastating 2-0 win in the first leg. A cool, controlled 1-1 draw in the return at Old Trafford sealed qualification for the quarter-finals. Klopp knew the next opponents quite well, Borussia Dortmund. "These two games were certainly challenging for both of us and also for our friendship," says Borussia CEO Hans-Joachim Watzke, relieved that the saxophonist in the Marbella hotel lobby was finally concluded his medley of Kenny G's greatest hits. "We had to do some things we usually wouldn't have done." Watzke had implored the players to get into competitive mode, out of their hugging mode, ahead of the emotional reunion with their former manager. "He wants to kill our team and the fans with kindness," the BV boss had warned. "But we aren't playing against our friend Kloppo. We mustn't lose our aggression." Watzke emphasizes that he hadn't said anything disrespectful. "All I said was, these games cannot turn into the Jurgen Klopp festival. I had heard that he was a little miffed about that, and from the way his family greeted me ahead of the return leg in Liverpool, I could tell he had indeed taken it badly. It also annoyed him that it worked." It had only worked up to a point, however. As Watzke is quick to admit, the crowd at the Signal Iduna Park were ready for battle, but the players found it hard to come to terms with Klopp sitting on the opposition bench. "In a normal game, we would beat them," says Watzke, "but this wasn't a normal game. At the beginning, the team were completely inhibited. You could feel that we lacked bite in the first half. It probably would have been worse if I hadn't talked so much to the players and the people around the club beforehand." Klopp could not hide that the return to the Westfalia had touched him too. "I lied if I told you that all the stuff going on didn't somehow knock me sideways," he said, after the 1-1 draw. The ice-cool facade that he had put on the day before, he now confessed, had been just that. "I prefer being here than in North Korea," he had joked on the eve of the game. "I don't think there will be a big emotional effect on me. We will change, get out there and play. That's it." For Dortmund, it certainly wasn't. Unable to play to the incredibly high standards of their season thus far, the Thomas Tuchel coach side only truly got going well into the second half. Due to the away goals rule, the advantage lay with Liverpool. "Anfield will burn," Klopp threatened. His competitive streak trumped all emotional connections to former comrades in arms, temporarily at least. "I bumped into him outside the changing rooms. They're very close together at Anfield. And wished him a good game," says BVB team manager Frinslan Sherman. He went, "Listen, you arse. I don't want to see a good game. I want to win." At first, it was Dortmund that laid fire to Liverpool's home. The Bundesliga side's mazy, cutting runs in the final third completely overwhelmed the flat-footed defence of the Merseysiders to give the Black and Yellows a 2-0 lead within 9 minutes. The Premier League team needed 3 goals to advance against vastly superior opposition. The game was over. Klopp thought otherwise. In the dressing room at half-time, he showed his team clips of 3 Liverpool attacking moves that had nearly paid off, assuring them that more chances were bound to come. He also reminded the players of the club's capacity to triumph in the most unlikely circumstances, mentioning the comebacks of all comebacks, Liverpool's Champions League win over AC Milan in Istanbul 2005 after going 3-0 down in the first 45 minutes. "He told us we should create something that we could tell our grandchildren about one day," said Origi. The Belgian striker's goal shortly after the restart did bring some hope. But Dortmund struck back to win the tie a second time when Marco Reus completed another fine combination on 57 minutes. Liverpool's heads dropped. Anfield was ready to accept the inevitable. One man dressed in all white was not. Klopp said he could smell, hear, and sense the sensation. He egged on the crowd to scream until the hopelessness was drowned out by defiance. It felt as if he had brought himself on as a 12th factor, as an instigator and motivator for the players and the fans, wrote Die Welt. He cooked up a storm on the touchline. He's good like that, says Watzke. Using the power of the crowd against us was legitimate. It was his job in retrospect, just as it had been my job in the first leg. But it was nevertheless strange for us. I've rarely seen something like that at the level of severity. Norbert Dickel, too, felt somehow hurt that Klopp turned the stadium against them. I didn't like the fact that he whipped up the fans like that, says the former BVB striker. It was professional from his point of view. It was the right thing in his eyes, but not in ours. He could have done without doing that. I know he'll never admit that, but I'm not upset with him anymore. Philippe Coutinho scored to make it 2-3 on 66 minutes. Liverpool had clawed their way back to a two-goal deficit. The Germans continued to play really impressively, technically far ahead of their hosts. But this was one of those nights when the noise at Anfield becomes a weapon and opposition hearts wilt in the floodlight. A mythical force grabbed hold of the contest and pulled it into the realm of fantasy or nightmares, depending on your viewpoint. We started shitting ourselves, Mats Hummel said later. Dortmund was so shaken that different parts of the team were playing different systems. As soon as Mamadou Sakho headed in the Reds' third goal 12 minutes from time, Watzke knew it was all over. I resigned myself to losing at that point, he says. We knew how much power Jürgen could generate on the touchline. It's no coincidence we scored many goals in the 89th minute. Against Malaga, he had been the only guy in the stadium believing we could still do it, and we did it. At 3-3, it was only a question of time before we would concede again. And then the whole stadium... He doesn't finish the sentence. Overcome by horror and admiration. Karl-Heinz Riedel and Yuri Sahin had both played at Anfield, but they told me they had never seen anything like that. That's Jürgen's doing. Dejan Lovren made the madness a reality 2 minutes into injury time. Klopp could not believe the ball had actually crossed the line at first. Anfield was shouting his name at the final whistle over and over again. The German manager departed the arena like a gladiator exiting the Colosseum following the slaying of a formidable beast, wrote the Independent. His vanquished opponent, Tuchel, found it impossible to come to terms with the result. I can't explain it because there are no logical explanations. Emotions won the day, he said, staring into the middle distance in utter desolation. Unlike the experienced miracle worker Klopp, he hadn't been able to anticipate the approaching insanity. Such an irrational turn of events was beyond the realms of his imagination. He had no means to intervene effectively. It was one of the worst defeats during my 12 years at Dortmund, says Watzke. Not because of Jürgen. I was even pleased for him at the end. No. We were so close to winning an international trophy. I think we would have won it. We got knocked out in Liverpool. But actually, we had already lost the tie in Dortmund, I feel. It took a month before his relationship with the former Borussia coach recovered, he adds. I don't think I'll ever experience something similar, but our friendship is strong enough to endure. I know it might sound funny, but if I'm being completely honest, I thought he deserved it, says former BVB midfielder Ilkay Gundogan, now at Manchester City. Even though we got knocked out and were really hurt, I was pleased for him. Lun Sherman had noticed the same signs of involuntary fraternization. His former players still feel a strong emotional bond with him. You could see it when Sven Bender went to high-five him while warming up. I don't think everybody liked it, but it's understandable. Liverpool's owners, FSG, had seen enough. That April, they approached him and his staff with an offer to extend their contracts to 2022. When you have an individual of Jürgen's quality in the building, it makes perfect sense to secure that person for the long term. Principal owner John Henry, Chairman Tom Werner, and FSG President Mike Gordon declared after the new deal was signed in July. To not do so would be irresponsible. In exchange for the board's commitment to him, Klopp pledged eternal loyalty. I will never go to another Premier League club, he assured the Americans. Both FSG and the coaching staff agreed that the team's limited resources were best focused on winning the Europa League during the last 2 months of the season. Liverpool still tried to make headway in the league, of course, but the emphasis had firmly shifted to winning the final in Basel. Villarreal were duly brushed aside without too much trouble in the penultimate round, but holders Seville were made from sterner stuff. Unai Emery's team were unimpressed by Daniel Sturridge's wonderful angled open goal, 35 minutes, and staged a powerful comeback after the break, scoring three times to claim the trophy for a third consecutive time. Reflecting on the defeat, Krawietz puts Liverpool's second-half collapse down to a mixture of physical exhaustion and getting it in the neck mentally, by conceding Kevin Gamiero's equaliser 1 minute after the restart. The stability was missing. The first half was all right without being all that good. In retrospect, I feel that the spell after the break was Seville's last chance. They went for it in a clever way. They picked up momentum and managed the turnaround. We were mentally prepared that they would go for it and that we would get chances to counterattack on the basis of being 1-0 up. The plan was to wait for them to lose their nerve. But they kick off and the ball's in the net. They were like, hurrah! We were like, ah! We couldn't come back from that, and also had nothing left in the tank physically. I know from my own experience how difficult it is to win a European trophy, says former LFC defender Jamie Carragher. That's why losing the final was a big disappointment. But you think of the journey and the legendary nights along the way. Manchester, Villarreal, Borussia Dortmund. The big one. Happy memories can never quite fill up that empty space in the trophy cabinet. But if you're lucky, they'll stay with you forever. Just like the silverware would have done. Chapter 9. Starts and Stops. Erkensingen, Frankfurt, Mainz, 1983-2001. Word of the 15-year-old village Wunderkind swept through the region like the cool Black Forest mountain wind. Gracious under pressure, always ahead of the game by about 2 seconds, blessed with silky feet, he was evidently special, and Jürgen was his name. Jürgen Haug. The teenage prodigy played in Ulrich Rath's SV Glatten youth team with Harmut Hardy Rath and Jürgen Klopp. And he was so good that TUS Erkensingen, the area's most renowned club for budding footballers, agreed to take him on. But Haug's parents were reluctant to drive the 60-kilometre round trip to take their son to training and games in the suburb of Rottenburg. Walter Bauer, the much-respected Erkensingen coach, had to think on his feet. He extended his offer to Klopp on the understanding that his mother, Lisbeth, would give Haug a lift 3 times a week. That's how Klopp, ever eager to belittle his own football abilities in retrospect, told the story. The late Bauer, he passed away in 2012, admitted to Die Zeit that Haug was clearly the greater talent, but Klopp and Rath, who also made the move east, must have been able to play a bit too. Erkensingen was as far away as FC Barcelona for us, Klopp said in an interview with Der Tagesspiegel in 2012. If you were considered good enough by Walter Bauer, you'd made it. Ulrich Rath says some people in Glatten are still upset with him, over 30 years later, for letting the three boys go. They don't realise that Erkensingen was a huge opportunity for them, a real chance to get ahead, he says. His son Hartmut ultimately proved too slow to make it into professional football, and Haug's progress, too, came to a halt. We had at least 5 players with similar basic skills, Bauer said. But that's not everything. If Klopp put his mind to something, he made it happen. Supported by his parents, who thought nothing of getting up well before 6 in the morning to drive him to games, Klopp duly established himself as Erkensingen's captain and a regular goal scorer. Bauer's approach, far ahead of its time, was key for the youngster's development. The Erkensingen coach wanted his players to spend as much time with the ball as possible, rather than clock up hours on endurance runs around the pitch. He had travelled to Brazil, met Pelé there, and been inspired by futsal, a five-a-side version of the game that forced players to hone their skills and creativity. We had to juggle the ball for 30 minutes before every training session, Klopp recalled. After 6 months, we could have starred as performing seals at Christmas parties. Bauer had been diagnosed with cancer of the stomach in 1977, but refused to give up. He was one of those men whose limitless love for football makes it possible for 6 million registered players to kick a ball around in Germany. Hermann Bauer, no relation, the team's general manager, has a fine collection of photos and press clippings from TUS Erkensingen's under-19s exploits in 1984 to 1985. They only finished third in the league, but picked up a number of other trophies. Ergenzingen came third in an indoor tournament with teams from the Soviet bloc in Katowice, Poland, in March 1985. The Germans, hailed as great ambassadors for their country in a local newspaper report, visited Auschwitz. It was very moving, Klopp was quoted as saying, and gave their hosts a set of football kits and five balls. They received a vase made from coal in return. It was a real coming together of East and West, said the article. The Cold War was still ongoing. Later that year, Klopp, Haug and teammate Ralf Schoenbrand travelled to Hamburg to pick up the second prize in a competition sponsored by aftershave brand Hattrick. Ergenzengen's strike force had notched up 10 hat-tricks at under-19 level that season. Only Kimi Vergers had done better with 13. In Hamburg, a selection of the competition winners, including 1990 World Cup winner Bode Illner in goal, lined up against HSV Legends team featuring Uwe Seeler. The iconic striker handed Klopp the second-place award at the festive banquet at the Plaza Hotel. Klopp had scored the winner in the exhibition match. Walter Bauer's team went on to win the annual International Pentecost Day tournament he'd been organising in his hometown since the early 70s. Viktor Vítězslav of Czechoslovakia had been the better side in the final, and Bauer was minded to let them win on penalties after the 120 minutes had ended goalless. Klopp told his coach he was mad. "We will convert every single kick now," he vowed. The home side won 3-2. Klopp admired Bauer so much that he threatened the club he would leave if the coach wasn't allowed to take over the first team where he would be playing in the 1986-1987 season. Ergenzingen relented. In one of his first games with the seniors, the 19-year-old Klopp came up against Bundesliga club Eintracht Frankfurt, who had decamped to the Black Forest for their pre-season training. De Lunisch Diva, the temperamental diva, as they were colloquially known, weren't in a forgiving mood. Dietrich Weiss's side hammered their hosts, despite missing 7 regulars and not trying too hard. Being on the wrong end of a humiliating 9-1 scoreline might have persuaded one or two of the Ergenzingen amateurs to try their hand at a different sport. But for TUS forward Jürgen Klopp, the match on the 21st of July 1986 was a breakthrough of sorts. That summer day when Dietrich Weiss visited the Black Forest, many decisive things for my life were set in motion, he acknowledged in an interview with Tagesspiegel in 2012. He took me to the Frankfurt region, a much bigger stage for football than the Black Forest. Klopp had scored Ergenzengen's consolation goal, and, the story goes, nearly added a second, sprinting past elegant Frankfurt defender Thomas Berthold, the Germany international, who'd just come back a runner-up from the World Cup in Mexico. Weiss was impressed. As a former national youth team coach, he had an expert's eye for up-and-coming talent and would play a key role in the reformation of Germany's grassroots system at the turn of the millennium. Berthold can still vividly remember the training camp in the Black Forest. It was very beautiful, and how he had gone back into full training with barely a break after the final against Diego Maradona's Argentina at the Azteca Stadium. But the former AS Roma and Bayern Munich defender admits he has no recollection of the game versus Ergenzengen itself, let alone Klopp as an opponent. He finds the suggestion that he was outrun by a lanky amateur in Congress, verging on offensive. "He did what? He dashed past me? Never," he laughs. "I ran 100 metres in less than 11 seconds at that time. Maybe I let him go, to gift them a goal." What is certain is that Weiss approached Klopp about a move to Frankfurt after the game. "I was so excited that I broke my Spezi glass," Klopp said. A Spezi is a mixture of Coke and Fanta, the non-alcoholic cocktail of choice in the mid-1980s West Germany. Nevertheless, he had to politely turn down the offer. "Jürgen told me that he had to finish his Arbiter, A-levels, first." Weiss, 82, says, "We agreed that we would speak again in a year's time." Weiss's friend, Walter Bauer, promised to send regular updates about the forward's progress. Frankfurt, almost 3 hours away by car from Glatten, was still not a viable destination as long as Klopp was still in school. But Oberliga, 4th Division, Club 1 FC Forsheim, were a different proposition. Situated in a 120,000-inhabitant town, 70 minutes to the north of the Black Forest, the side, coached by Bernd Hoffmann, a former Bundesliga 2 striker for Heilbronn and Karlsruhe, no relation to the Hamburger SV CEO, offered a useful step-up for Klopp. He was well known in the area as a young and dangerous attacker, says Hoffman. I'd watched him in many games for Ergun Ziggen and saw how many goals he scored. His presence in the box, due to his height, and also his pace, was impressive. Forsheim and Ergun Ziggen officials met at a service station halfway, where 12,000 Deutschmarks, or 6,000 euros in cash, was handed over in exchange for Klopp's signature. He spent 6 months driving there and back for games and training in his sister Stephanie's yellow Golf. Between 3,000 and 5,000 people turned up at the stadion in Brotzingertal for the games. Klopp was largely a spectator too. He featured only 4 times and drew blanks in front of goal. He couldn't make the transition to Oberliga, Hoffman says. He was frustrated, as you could imagine, but he respected that there were people in the team that were tough to displace. His attitude in training, apart from the odd quick outburst, was always spot on. Forsheim was a dead end, but Eintracht Frankfurt hadn't forgotten about him. Jürgen, me, and a few schoolmates won a post-Arbiter trip, travelling around southern Europe by train in the summer of 1987, says Hartmut Ruth. About 10 days in, we had reached a very remote spot on the island of Crete. Jürgen hadn't spoken with his parents in a while, but there were no mobile phones then. A tiny fisherman's boat took him to a post station. Good of you to call, his mother Lisbeth said. You have to go to Frankfurt for a trial. Jürgen thought about it for a couple of days, then took a train by himself from Athens, a 48-hour ride to Stuttgart. Norbert Klopp, his old Reich adds, agreed for Klopp to move to Frankfurt only if they arranged a place at the Goethe University in Frankfurt for him to study sports science. Klopp did well enough at the football and casting session with the Eagles to get a contract. But it was with Eintracht Frankfurt Amateur, the B team made up of reserves and young talents who played competitive football in the regional third division, Oberliga Hessen, and weren't allowed to be promoted into the proper professional football of the Bundesliga and Bundesliga 2. Klopp's mentor, Weiss, had been relieved of his duty 6 months earlier. Karl-Heinz Feldkamp, an altogether a more old-fashioned coach, had no use for the teenage prospect in the first team. This blonde, tall, very tanned guy with a moustache and steel-framed glasses showed up, speaking in a very strong Swabian dialect, says Eintracht Amateur striker Sven Müller. He was supposed to be my partner in attack, so I thought I'd better take a closer look. Jürgen told me he'd just been on holiday in Greece, and that it had been so hot that he sweated driving a scooter. He imitates the Swabian inflection, a high-pitched melody composed of sh sounds that grates a little in the ear of non-locals. You shit on the scooter and schwet. Da shit schaft auf der Vespa und schwit schwet. Müller, 2 years Klopp's senior, was technically more accomplished and a much better finisher. Klopp hardly got any starts under coach Hubert Neu, who, perhaps predictably, disliked the fact the 20-year-old was working late shifts in a bar in Frankfurt's nightlife district, Sachsenhausen, to supplement his meagre income. His substitute appearances for Amateur didn't leave the best of impressions either. Klopp's most noticeable moment in a barren season, Müller says, came in a game against SG Huist. The match was tied 1-1, or 0-0, with only a couple of minutes to go. Klopp was brought on. We were awarded a free kick. One of our players stepped up and smashed it into the corner. We started celebrating wildly, but then the referee blew his whistle and chalked it off. Klopp had pushed over 2 opponents in the wall. The team were not best pleased. Football aside, the Black Forest lad had a very good time in the big city. Müller had been instructed by Norbert Neu, the general manager of the Oberliga Hessen side, to look after Klopp and teammate Armin Bonn, who were both new in town and living in student digs. He took his task very seriously. We went out in Sachsenhausen at night, drinking cider. Never the night before games, we were too professional for that, but after and during the week sometimes. We were rivals, but we bonded due to a similar love for life and sense of humour. We rocked the city. We went everywhere they had some nice shining lights. Luckily, there were no camera phones then. Nobody caught us out. Müller is convinced that those days, or rather nights, prepared Klopp for dealing with young players as a manager later on. He knows exactly what young men are like at that age. You're still a child, really. You go off the rails sometimes, you have to. He can relate to that, because he was the same. At Frankfurt, Klopp got his first taste of coaching. Together with amateur teammate Michael Gabriel, he took charge of the under-11s. For For 400 Deutschmark, a winter coat, and an Eintracht season ticket, as he told the Sunday Times' Jonathan Norcroft in January 2017. We, the two coaches and the players, had a lot of fun together, Gabriel said. Klopp enjoyed the experience so much that he continued coaching the same squad of players in the following season, after he'd left to play for Victoria Sindlingen in the city's periphery. It was my first real decision as a coach to keep all of these guys, he said. The club wanted to change them for younger kids. Klopp won that particular battle, but eventually found he had too much on his plate to keep instructing the youngsters. Right-sided midfielder Patrick Glockner was the only one of Kloppo's kids to make it into the Bundesliga, 14 games for Eintracht Frankfurt and Stuttgarter Kickers in 1997 to 1998. The friendship between Müller and Klopp lasted well beyond that 1 year at Frankfurt's second team. Müller, an event organiser and PR expert, arranged the festivities for Klopp's beach wedding to Ulla, his second wife, in 2006. They had earlier married civilly at the registrar's office in Mainz-Gossenheim. Klopp wore bleached-out jeans, a striped blazer, and an untucked striped shirt. And Christian Heidel had arranged for the singer Thomas Negger and his band to perform Im Schatten des Doms, in the shadow of the cathedral, a Mainz anthem that had become part of the stadium DJ's repertoire on direct orders of the FSV coach. Jürgen is just a great guy, Müller says. Funny, authentic, and a good man who knows what's important in life. He hasn't forgot where he came from and values good friendship. He's the cool boy next door. Unless he's involved in any kind of football game, then all coolness goes out of the window. On a family holiday in Turkey a couple of years ago, Müller was playing a five-a-side team with Klopp's sons, Mark and Dennis. Klopp himself was injured but coached the team with real passion, giving detailed instructions from the sidelines. I had to go off because it was extremely hot and I'm quite old, Müller recalls. I think we were narrowly in the lead. Kloppo, in his inimitable style, came up to me and slapped me softly across the face. You will score one more goal. You'll score one more, he told me. I went back on and did indeed score one more. He's got this doggedness when it comes to winning football games. Even when it's just for fun on a beach somewhere. Cannot help himself. But as far as his Eintracht Frankfurt career was concerned, no help from the men in charge was forthcoming. Hubert Neuss' designated successor as amateur coach, Jürgen Spaßwasser, the famous goal scorer in East Germany's 1-0 win over World Cup winners West Germany in 1974, told Klopp in the spring of 1988 that he didn't feature in his plans for the subsequent season. Jürgen was basically pushed out, says Müller. Dietrich Weiss still felt the young Swabian had potential, however. Weiss was by now coaching Al Ahly in Cairo, Egypt, and had set up the first regional training centre for talented youngsters in the Frankfurt area 10 years before the German FA would accept his blueprint for youth development and roll out these Stützpunkte all across the nation. Weiss, too, acted as a consultant for Victoria Sindlingen, a third division part-timer team unglamorously situated right next to the Horst chemical plant in the westerly suburb of Frankfurt. Norbert Nehaus remembers Weiss's sales pitch. He came up to me and said, I bought in this player from Forsheim. He doesn't really get on at Eintracht, but I believe he's got something. I believe he has something to give football. Maybe it'll work if he takes a detour via Sindlingen. Neuhaus's diary shows that he met Klopp at the ground of FC Homburg on the 16th of April 1988 for a first talk. By May, they had an agreement. Sindlingen bought the striker from Eintracht for 8,000 Deutschmarks, or 4,000 euros, and he was paid 1,200 Deutschmarks, or 600 euros, per month in cash, but only during the season, little more than pocket money. Sindlingen were in the relegation zone for most of the campaign. Teammate Axel Schubert sensed Klopp's frustration. He hadn't made the sort of progress as a player he had hoped for. He probably found it hard concentrating on football in those days, what with his sports science studies in Frankfurt and a heavily pregnant girlfriend. His son Mark was born in December 1988. The year wasn't without some sweet moments, however. Away to his former team, Eintracht Amateur, Klopp scored 4 goals in a 6-0 win. It was horrible for us and great for him, says Müller. He sent a nice message to Spaßwasser that day. Look at what you're missing. Neuhaus, 71, has proudly kept a match report of Sindlingen's 2-0 defeat away to Rot-Weiss Frankfurt from November 1988. He was in charge of the team as caretaker that day, after coach Gunter Dutene, an ex-Mainz 05 captain, had been fired. "I've told my grandchildren that I managed the great Jurgen Klopp for one game," he laughs. "He wasn't a rocket, to be honest, but always involved and present for every training session." Sindlingen's new boss, Ramon Berndroth, had the team play a game in his first training session to learn about his players' strengths and weaknesses. Less than 30 minutes in, Berndroth stopped the session and singled out one player for a bollocking, Klopp. Klopp enjoyed revisiting that story in front of everyone in the VIP room of Dortmund's youth team stadium, Rotter Erde, when he spotted Berndroth watching a game there years later, says Neuhaus. Berndroth, who's been working as a youth team coach in recent years, told Neuhaus that he'd never before come across a Bundesliga coach who didn't just know all his youth team players, down to the reserves, but also all of their backgrounds and biographical information. As a player, Klopp was ambitious and knew how to look after himself on the pitch. He was no snowflake, Schubert reports. He also had no qualms telling his older teammates how they can improve technically. After the game, he would think about the team's performance. I'd say there were small hints that he could read a game. Klopp's aerial prowess saw Berndroth devise a set-play routine. It came off at the crucial moment of Sindlingen's season. They were playing FC Erbach in a one-game relegation playoff at a neutral ground and were tied 2-2 with 20 minutes to go when Walter Braun floated in a corner towards the near post. Schubert headed the ball on towards the second post where Klopp rose to power it into the net. Sindlingen won 4-2. In 2009, Neuhaus sent Klopp a DVD with shaky home video footage of the game. "You don't make a bad impression at all," he wrote, adding that he'd seen the trick replicated by Klopp's Mainz team. Klopp phoned and thanked him profusely. He and Schubert met on the pitch at Mainz again, but not as players. "I was working as a groundsman for the city of Mainz and looked after the pitch of the Bruchweg Stadion, which was owned by the municipality then," Schubert says. The first day on the job, Mainz were training in the stadium. Klopp was very surprised to see me. He was on the other side of the pitch where his team was stretching and ran across to hug me full of joy. "What are you doing here?" and so on. We spoke for a long time and the stretching exercises lasted a little longer. He has always had time for former players and coaches. For their coach Helmut Jakob's birthday, the Sindlingen team organised for him to do a coaching session with Klopp in Mainz. He agreed straight away. Jakob came back buzzing, with a poster showing him and Klopp next to each other on the training pitch. Klopp's total of 14 goals in 1987 to 1988 had played a part in saving Sindlingen from the drop, but the club had expected more, Neuhaus says. By our standards, the wages were very high. Fortunately for Klopp, another team, stuck in the same lowly division but with deeper pockets and much bigger ambitions, had shown an interest. Rot-Weiss Frankfurt. A friend of mine had told me there's this right winger at Sindlingen that you'll like, Dragoslav Stepi Stepanovic says. Stepanovic, a former international for Yugoslavia, had moved to Germany in the late 70s, playing for Eintracht Frankfurt before an outing at Manchester City 1979-1981. After retirement, he opened a well-frequented pub, Steffi's Treff, in Frankfurt city centre and became friends with many of the city's influential people. Eintracht Frankfurt's general manager, Bernard Holzenbein, his former teammate, appointed Stepanovic as coach in 1991, and his young side, featuring luminaries such as Uwe Bein, Andy Muller, and Anthony Yeboa, very nearly won the Bundesliga with football so fast and exciting that it was dubbed Fußball 2000 by the German media. Stepanovic, a cigar-smoking natural showman with a Mexican bandit's moustache, an idiomatic Hessian-Serbian dialect, and a liking for salmon-coloured blazers, was the nascent commercial TV station's darling. He once sang Frank Sinatra's My Way on a football programme. A couple of years earlier, Steppi had been entrusted to take Eintracht's much smaller neighbours, Rot-Weiss Frankfurt, from the semi-amateur Division 3 into Bundesliga 2. RW had a bit of money courtesy of benefactor Wolfgang Steubing, the champagne club the local media dubbed them. "We were the Bayern Munich of the Hessenliga," Stepanovic says. Stepanovic went to see a Sindlingen game to check out that tip-off. The right winger turned out to be Jurgen Klopp. "In that match he played like a god," the 68-year-old says. "He went past his man on the flank 1,000 times and put in great crosses. I would never have guessed from watching him that he had technical deficiencies. I liked players who were fast and wanted to have very attacking players on the flanks. RW Frankfurt paid a transfer fee of 8,000 Deutschmarks, 4,000 euros, to Sindlingen. Klopp was perhaps himself surprised to get a contract with RW, Stepanovic says. Pre-season brought disillusion for both men. Klopp clearly wasn't the player Stepanovic thought he'd bought. After 3-4 league games, I sent him to the second team. I got into trouble with people at the club. They wondered why I'd got him in the first place and called him a failure. He even sat on the bench in the second team. He simply didn't have enough to play in the starting 11. I thought, is it possible that I got it so wrong? Steppy told me that I was his wife and daughter's favourite player, but that he could not play me regardless. Klopp said in a talk with Ruud Nachrichten in 2014. I think I could have sat in my jeans on the bench for half a year. He wouldn't have noticed at all. The RW coach resolved to give the forward another chance after the winter break. He brought him back into the fold with the first team and changed his role to a nine. As a target man, Klopp suddenly started scoring goals in industrial quantities. 3, 6, 10. He hit the net in every training session. In the air, nobody got near him. His headers were sensational. He got 14 in the second half of the season for us, to take us to the Heisenliga title in 1989-1990. His goals won us the championship. Stepanovic believed that Klopp was predestined for a career in football without boots. I always thought, this guy is such a good talker at such a young age. He'll probably become a general manager or sporting director one day. I never thought he'd be a coach. That came as a great surprise to me. He always spoke his mind, never hid his thoughts. After the ups and downs we had, we weren't the best of friends. But I liked that he never gave up. Legend has it that Mainz coach Robert Jung signed Klopp after Rot-Weiss Frankfurt twice played and lost against Mainz in the Bundesliga 2 playoff round in the summer of 1990. But Stepanovic reveals that the striker had already signed for FSV at the end of the regular season, a few weeks earlier. When we celebrated winning the division, I saw Jürgen sit in the dressing room smoking a cigarette. I was a smoker myself and had to laugh. I said to him, if I had known you smoked, I'd have played you more often. That day, he told us that he was off to Mainz. We were disappointed, but for him, it was a logical step. Age 23, Jürgen Klopp had become a real professional at last. On the other end of the phone line, you can hear Herman Hummels chuckle before he's even started the sentence. With Kloppo, it was hard to tell, he says, pausing for effect. Was it a first touch or a shot at goal? Jürgen Klopp, by his own admission, was not a short-trousered magician. He described himself as an aggressive arsehole on the pitch, Taz, in 2004, as a mentality and fighting machine, extremely good in the air and very fast, Der Tagesspiegel in 2012. But technically, he conceded, he wasn't good enough. I realised my own limits before others did. To sum it up, in my head, I was Bundesliga and my feet were Landesliga. The result was Bundesliga 2. I quickly accepted it. To be upset would have been a waste of time. He was far too thrilled to dwell on his deficits. I couldn't believe that I was a professional footballer, he said. I would have paid for being allowed to play football at the time. At Christian Heidel's 20th anniversary party as Mainz sporting director in 2012, Klopp recalled the time Heidel saw a Homburg player miscontrol the ball horribly in a game and exclaim, look, they also have a Kloppo. His ineptitude as a player might have become exaggerated a bit, by himself and others, for good effect. His former Mainz 05 teammate, Guido Schaffer, now a football journalist based in Leipzig, has a more nuanced take. Jürgen was well aware of his strengths and weaknesses, he says. He didn't attempt to dribble because he couldn't. But he was incredibly fast. He didn't look that quick over the first few metres, but once he got going, you could hardly keep up with him. His time over 100 metres was very good. He certainly wasn't a total disaster. You don't get to play 325 league games in the second division if you can't kick a ball. He was a very important player for the team for many years due to his performances and his exemplary attitude. Starting out as a centre-forward, Klopp scored a respectable 10 goals in his first season at the Bruchweg, 1990 to 1991, and notched up another 8 by February in his second campaign, which included his most glorious moment as a professional, a 4-goal outing away to RW Erfurt. Mainz won 5-0. That was his shining hour, says Martin Kvast, who reported on the match for a local paper. Kloppo mounted the fence to celebrate with the 2 dozen Mainz supporters who had made the trip. The photo I took has been printed hundreds of times since. Klopp times four, in a white shirt with a big four on the back. Fantastic. Soon after that feat, the lanky but mobile forward was contacted by the veritable Bundesliga giant Hamburger SV. They had the hots for him, says Schaffer, but they couldn't get him for whatever reason. Years later, they missed out on appointing him as their coach, too. One club, two dramatic mistakes. Klopp was understandably desperate for the switch, trading the tough second division slog for a much more financially rewarding shot at the big time. But according to Mainz president Harald Strutz, FSV coach Robert Jung vetoed the move. He threatened to resign if the club let his first choice attacker go. Klopp was very angry at the time. You don't get a chance like that every day, Strutz says. But he accepted it. He understood that we were struggling to stay up with the players we had and couldn't afford anyone leaving. You have to say, we got very lucky that it panned out this way. At first, however, the effect was entirely negative. In the wake of HSV's failed attempt to take him north, Klopp scored only three more times over the course of the next 18 months. He was moved back into defence, and Mainz's goals dried up altogether as their relative illiquidity began to bite. Year after year, the only aim was to somehow stay up, says Hummels, who coached the team for a six-month spell in 1994-95, after a couple of years as assistant manager. Come April and May, the bosses would go and light a candle in church, praying for salvation. We had been promoted in 1988, after 12 years as amateurs, then gone down and come up again. In truth, we didn't really belong in the second division at all, says Christian Heidel. When I arrived in 1992, we were in the relegation zone, and we went into the last game of the season at Darmstadt, knowing we could only afford to lose by one goal. And we lost by one goal. We had no training ground, no proper stadium, and no money. In 1994, our budget was 3.5 million Deutschmarks, or 1.75 million euros. That included all the youth teams as well. It wasn't until 1998 that FSV had their first player, Michael Müller, on 10,000 Deutschmarks, or 5,000 euros, per month, not per week. Klopp's salary was significantly smaller, in the low thousands, as was Schaffer's. In 1988-89, our first Bundesliga 2 season, we had three basic tiers, he says. 1,500 Deutschmarks, or 750 euros, a month for the blind. 2,500 Deutschmarks, or 1,250 euros, a month for the one-eyed. And 3,500 Deutschmarks, or 1,750 euros, for those who could see. I was with the one-eyed. Harald Strutz, the president, said to me, Guido, it'll be great, because you'll get 2,000 Deutschmarks for every win as a bonus on top. The problem was, we never won. Klopp jokingly said to his wife Ulla that Heidel didn't warrant a present for his 20th anniversary in charge at Mainz. I already played for free for him for 10 years. Signing his player contracts at Heidel's BMW car dealership, the de facto club offices at the time, had brought his modest wages into sharp focus early on. With the money he paid me, I could never afford the cars he was selling, Klopp laughed later. The club's only employee, an administrator, was a part-timer, showing up every other day to sort through the mail in a container. Mainz stadium announcer Klaus Hafner worked for free as the club's CEO. He sold tickets to the games at weekends, and another volunteer provided the stadium catering, homemade butter sandwiches. Quast remembers Hafner stalking fans in the city centre with a collection box at Christmas time, asking for funds to pay for tracksuits for the under-17s. Their old set was worn out. The only club merchandising they sold in 1995 were towels, Hummel says. I think they sold four. I still have mine. If anyone had said to me Mainz would be in the Bundesliga in 5, 7, or 8 years' time, I'd have bet everything I had against that. Ivan would have taken out a loan to bet more. It was simply unforeseeable. Mainz's reserve team, the under-21s, who Heidel had agreed to look after, were the worst in all of German professional football, playing in Kreisklasse C at the lowest level of the organised game. They didn't even have a complete set of shirts and came up against teams who couldn't actually play football at all, he smiles. Training for the first team, who was split up into VW minivans, was only possible if the groundsman of the publicly owned playing field agreed. The changing room inside the stadium was a mould-ridden wetland biotope, Schaffer bristles. You were afraid to hang your towel up in there. There was one big rusty bathtub in there, with room for four or five players, and if you spent too much time in there, you contracted all sorts of diseases. To never get relegated at that club with those players really was a tremendous achievement. Mainz's perma-desperation chewed up coaches. In Klopp's 11 years as an 05 player, he was managed by 14 different men. The instability at the top bred a certain lawlessness in the dressing room. It was a horde of pretty wild players, says Hummels. The police had to be called in a couple of times. Attacking midfielder Angsar Brinkmann, nicknamed the White Brazilian, for example, had a well-deserved reputation for partying. Playing for Osnabrück, he had once been stopped for driving under the influence in his Porsche Boxster, but managed to break out of the police car and run away on foot before they had checked his levels. He was let off. Heidel and Strutz put me up with Kloppo in hotels for away games. For him to keep an eye on me, he says. He always had his head in a book and I always watched a lot of television. He was like, turn that thing off, we have a game tomorrow. Kloppo, I replied, there's a stop sign for you at the halfway line tomorrow. Just give me the ball, I'll do the rest, because you can't play. He'd chuck a pillow or other things at me. One night, I threw the TV out of the window from the 8th floor. He woke up from the bang. Where's the TV, Angsgar? I threw it out of the window. Why? The film had a shit ending. Schaffer, still rocking a marvellous peroxide mane at 52, was a free spirit too. He'd sometimes come late to training or miss it altogether. I had to pay a lot of fines thanks to Kloppo, who was on the players' council. The coaches would usually let the council decide on the size of the fees, and Kloppo showed no mercy. Thank you, Kloppo. I once paid 500 Deutschmarks, 250 euros. I hadn't overslept or been to a pub. I was late because my cat had gone missing. Obviously, nobody believed me. Kloppo laughed. Your cat? Pull the other one. 500 Deutschmarks it is for you. 3 days later, we lost a game at Chemnitz. Hermann Hummel said, that was the first time a second division team has lost because of a cat. Another time, they took 1,000 Deutschmarks, 500 euros, off me for being out too long during a training camp. In his early 20s, Klopp was a saint by comparison, a good-natured, pretty quiet mustachio lad, a husband and young father who prayed underneath a towel before matches. On the way home from away games, he and others would gather around the flamboyant Schaffer in the last row of the bus and listen to tales of his rowdy pub crawls and women. Schaffer. He was the first one to sit there. He laughed as soon as I said the first sentence, and he was the last one to stop laughing. He caught fire easily. He always liked to listen. He wasn't a loud mouth then. He once told me that he picked up some of the quick wit and charm from all those rides in the last row of the bus. Klopp, Schaffer recalls, didn't eat like a top athlete. Grilled sausage and chips were his thing. And he smoked the odd cigarette underneath the extractor fan in a hotel bathroom. But Brinkmann's recollection of Klopp's hotel rooms, being so full of smoke that you needed to hang up a disco globe to see anything, are in all likelihood a little embellished. Both agree that Klopp very rarely drank any alcohol. Schaffer. He always went straight home to Frankfurt after training. He didn't have a chance to paint the town red with us. On the few occasions he did have a drink, on a team night during training camp, it didn't much agree with him. He would have two long drinks and then throw up. He wasn't capable of going the distance at all. During the game, it was the opposite. Klopp's passion and commitment took him far in the rough-hewn environs of Bundesliga 2, possibly too far at times. No opponent has ever insulted me as much as he did, as my teammate, says Brinkmann. That's a fact. I played right in front of him. He constantly screamed at me. Ansgar, you idiot, get back into the formation, or if you don't come back right now, I'll do you, you donkey, get a move on. I was more afraid of him than I was of my opponent. He was always the first pick in training games because nobody wanted to play against him. When his team was down, he started bending the coach's ear until he forgot that the game should have already been over. Every one of those games lasted until Kloppo had won. You always wanted to be on his side. He wouldn't and couldn't lose. Klopp's desire to win, Schaffer concurs, was literally frightening. It got uncomfortable at times. He was very impulsive, hysterical, you might say. Choleric. At one game in Saarbrücken, he came right up to me and screamed in my face for half a minute. I'd conceded a corner, I think. 1 minute later, it was forgotten again, and he was your mate again. He's not always that smiling and hugging guy. He can be wild and he can be unfair. But he doesn't bear a grudge, which is just as well. Jürgen Cramny, another Mainz alumni, who had the pleasure or misfortune of playing directly in front of the highly strung right-back, has similar tales to tell. I was a good footballer, and it wasn't easy for me to have Kloppo behind me. He was loud. If I didn't help out enough, he moaned. Boy, could he moan. He used to lose it on the pitch. We would, shall we say, exchange frank views. I got in the odd bit of repartee, things like, if you played better passes, I wouldn't have to run so much. But using different language, he laughs. We could both handle it. By and large, it worked well for the two of us. Striker Sven Dumont, too, had a good working relationship with Klopp, aided by a bit of distance. Luckily, he was far away from me back in defence. I couldn't hear him scream that much. Cramley remembers one training ground incident that left Klopp a little angry, however. He sat on a movable small goal, and I stood before him over a ball. I pretended to take a shot. He jumped up, the goal toppled over, and he fell badly on his lower back. He got up and chased me around the pitch until he had to give up because the pain was too bad. He might still feel it today. In Bundesliga 2, a league made of mud, debt and fears, everybody hurt. Most of the time. Mainz, like the majority of clubs, fought a never-ending battle for survival, and aggression on the pitch and in the stands was considered a prerequisite. In a typical raucous affair at Waldorf Mannheim's Karl Benz Stadion in April 1994, Klopp made the mistake of putting his head through the gaps in the terrace fence to fling insults back to some Mannheim supporters. He was smacked in the face, says Schaffer. That was the last time he ever put his head through any stadium fence. Klopp's essential problem was that of the division on the whole. He wanted to play better football, but he couldn't. Schaffer. He often said that he had had the right idea of where the pass or cross should go, but sadly not the means. He knew how things worked, but his body was not able to make it happen, says Kvast. He once told me that he felt like a prisoner. That type of incarceration ultimately proved liberating, as Klopp was pushed to overcome his shortcomings below the neckline by thinking a lot harder about the game. Initially, his interest wasn't so much in tactics as in the socio-dynamic aspects of a football team, Hummels observed. He was curious about the social relations inside the dressing room and the club. Jürgen had a strong feel for that. He didn't say, I couldn't care less, I'm only here to do a job. He always thought of the team as a group of people. He was never an egotistical arsehole. Never. Never. The experience he had at Mainz 05 in terms of group dynamics under extreme pressure left a huge mark on him, says Peter Krawetz, Klopp's second assistant coach at Liverpool. Mainz constantly had their arses to the wall, to put it bluntly. The house was on fire all the time. They depended on everybody being prepared to put in everything. He learned an incredible amount about the things that make a football team tick in those years, and about the different characters you'll find in the game. I believe he's taken all these years in the dressing room, reflected on them, and found that many things can be sorted with a bit of common sense. He has a feel for the situation, for saying the right thing at the right moment in the right manner. Looking back at his sports science course at Frankfurt's Goethe University, which he continued with until graduating with the equivalent of a bachelor's degree in 1995, Klopp believes his studies were just as beneficial, however. They are the basis of everything I later did, he said in December 2013. He learned about training theory, ergotherapy, and psychomotility, the connection between mental traits and bodily movement. Without knowing it at the time, I was working on the thing I could do best and wanted to do most. Coaching. Klopp added that studying also taught him to work independently and the importance of effort. You either benefit very directly or things blow up in your face if you don't put enough in. You can't learn these things as easily at other places. In an interview with Der Tagesspiegel in 2012, he admitted that he was not a model student. I had a family and had to earn money playing football. But he added, dealing with educators, psychologists and sociologists and knowing about methodology has perhaps helped me find solutions as a coach without me realising. Studying possibly saved me from early failure as a coach. Despite his tight finances and even tighter schedule, he found being a student enjoyable. His only problems pertained to the course's quaint practical modules. Swimming wasn't his thing, nor was gymnastics, pole vaulting even less so. But why did a man whose football is so concerned with running do his university thesis on walking? According to Klopp, he had at first wanted to write about Rückenschule, preventative back pain therapy. Professor Klaus Boss, his tutor, didn't agree. There had been dozens of similar papers already. That might have been part of the attraction for Klopp, in fact. Boss instead pointed him to walking, a new trend sport from the US that nobody had examined scientifically before in Germany. Together with a fellow student, we conducted a proper study and collated statistics. It was cool, Klopp said. Klopp's footballing higher education was provided by Mainz coach Wolfgang Frank. His first spell at Bruchweg, 1995 to 1997, was tantamount to a tactical awakening for Klopp. He suddenly understood that